War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome back to Key Battles of the Pacific War in World War II. This is your host, James, as always. And we are now moving, finally, now that we're on the 19th episode, we're moving to our fifth key battle. But don't worry, we're not going to, that doesn't mean we're doing 38 episodes. Although we're going to do, it's going to be around 35. So it's
pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, pretty close. I shouldn't be too, make too many promises, but hopefully it will be worth it. Hopefully you enjoy every minute of it. In our last episode, we talked about how the United States Navy and the Marines and the Army are all conducting operations in several different parts of the Pacific, moving slowly, surely, but inexorably toward the Japanese home islands. We talked last time in our previous episode about the Japan's new operational policy, which was basically pulling back their long defensive line, thousands of miles long, abandoning some of their former possessions in an effort to try to hold on to that which they still had. Talked about the U.S. invasion of Biak, Caroline Islands, especially the massive naval air base of Truk, which the Americans eliminated essentially, and then the decision to move even further to Japan and take the Marianas. We talked about the Japanese fleet and the American fleet, which would be coming to oppose it. And now, at last, we come to actual battle itself, the Battle of Saipan. Scott is with me as always, and Scott is in the leadoff position in today's game. So, Scott, what do you have to bring for us? Kick us off.
All right. Well, we talked about the importance of Saipan in previous episodes, that conquering it does a number of things. It cuts off Japan from its southern empire, where much of its resources are, and taking Saipan will quickly push Japan into a resource-starved position. But more so what it does is it clears the way for further advances into Tokyo. And this isn't just making it easier for a land conquest. What it does is that you can have an air base in Saipan, which allows the United States to strike the Japanese homeland, specifically with its new long-range bomber, the B-29 Super Fortress. I'm sure we'll talk about this way more in other episodes. We've only really looked closely at the fighters, the Wildcats and the Hellcats, and what that means with dogfighting with Japanese Zeros and when carrier attack groups get close to one another. But the strategy of the United States is going to shift toward long-range bombing runs, which we'll see much more. And conquering Saipan opens up all sorts of strategic possibilities. Very important island. Japan knows this. And why this battle is going to be the way that it is. And it's been horrific up to this point. We've talked about bonsai runs and island-to-island fighting, Marines and Army taking out Japanese pillboxes with flamethrowers, but it's going to be ugly. So that's setting the stage there.
All right, let's talk about Saipan. It's 12 miles long and about 5.5 miles wide, so not a particularly large island. But despite that, it's the second largest of the Marianas Islands after Guam. Its eastern side consists mostly of large cliffs, but on the western side, it has a long stretch of sandy beach. Saipan contains a ridge of volcanic mountains that run down the middle of both of its length. In the center of the island, Mount Tapochal rises to over 1,500 feet, and the western side had two towns. The island was defended by about 23,000 Japanese Army troops and 7,000 naval personnel, including members of the Special Naval Landing Force, for a total strength of about 30,000. The Japanese overall commander was a man we've met before multiple times, Admiral Chuichi Nagumo. He had been the overall commander of the Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor and at Midway. Now he's in command of a land garrison, kind of unusual for a naval officer, but there you go. But he also gave tactical control of the ground forces to Lieutenant General Yoshitsugu Saito. Defensive works were made of wood and earth rather than reinforced concrete. Now, here's something new. You may think, well, this sounds exactly like every other island invasion. But this time, Saipan is different because it contained 30,000 civilians. And these were mostly Japanese or Okinawans. Okinawans are ethnically distinct from the Japanese, although with a lot of similarities as well. So 30,000 civilians, and that's going to make things even more complicated. On June 13, 1944, American battleships fired more than 2,500 16-inch shells and many thousands more smaller shells. Each ship had a specific target. Specific, not a Pacific target.
But a target in the Pacific.
Yeah, they're firing out in the ocean. They're trying to kill as many fish as possible. Just kidding. So this is like they did at Kwajalein and other places we saw originally at the invasion of Tarawa. They did not have specific targets, and the bombardment didn't do much good at all. So they learned their lesson, and here they're putting the lesson into practice once again. The next day, two 96-man underwater demolition teams, UDTs, and these are the predecessors of Navy SEALs, they were transported to the edge of the coral reef off the coast. They used explosives to clear lanes for the landing craft, so they're blowing up some of the coral. That would not be praised by environmentalists, definitely not, but the Marines were very happy about that so that they could get as close to the beach as possible. And further out to the sea were the 15 carriers of Task Force 58. These carriers had nearly 1,000 planes. Their job was to protect the American invasion force from harassment from Japanese planes. All right, so there we go. Ready for the invasion, Scott?
All right, yeah, seems like the road is open.
Let's do it. On the 15th of June, the bombardment was lifted and the first elements of the 2nd and 4th U.S. Marine Divisions landed on Saipan's western shore. They would later be joined by the Army's 27th Division. Author John Tolan writes the following. He says, on the island, they would encounter more than one type of enemy. After facing sharks, barracuda, sea snakes, razor-sharp coral, poison fish, and giant clams in the surf, they would find worse hazards ashore. Leprosy, typhus, filariasis, typhoid, and dysentery, as well as snakes and giant lizards. It does not sound like a lot of fun. It reminds me of Guadalcanal, just all this horrible stuff. What else did they face? Maybe something that's not natural, something man-made.
Right. So we mentioned that when it comes to the initial landings, the Marines will face different things when they first arrive. I mean, sometimes there's nothing, and then deeper into the jungle, they'll face a counterattack. Other times, the Japanese are there on the shore. It can come to what sort of naval or air resistance the Japanese are facing. But there were numerous gun emplacements along beach cliffs. The battleships and destroyers and planes, like James said, did pound key targets in the pre-assault bombardments. But they didn't get everything. They'd missed many gun emplacements along the beach cliffs. So for many Marines, when they first arrive, they, after battling nature, like James said, they run straight into exploding bombs and gunfire. It's different on different places on Saipan, but it's no easy walk onto the beach when they first arrive.
Definitely not somewhere I would want to be, but thank goodness that these brave young men did that as well, and some of them not so young. But anyway, the first invasion wave got onto the shore with few casualties, but the second to fifth waves encountered heavy resistance, especially on the southernmost part of the island. By the way, you're going to want to, listener, you want to pull up a map of Saipan. It's very long, but quite narrow. It's kind of shaped, I guess, roughly, very loosely speaking, kind of like a football that's standing up and down, like it's about to be kicked off. So, and they're landing again on the eastern side, or if you're looking at a regular map, the left side, and up and down from north to south. Let's see, where was it? By the end of the first day, 20,000 Marines were on the shore, although five battalion commanders were killed. So we're talking colonels and lieutenant colonels. These are pretty high up officers. On the second day, which is the 16th, the Americans slowly but surely pushed inland. That evening, Saito ordered a night attack. Saito, of course, is the Japanese lieutenant general who's got tactical control over the forces on the island. And in this night attack, he brought tanks, he had infantry, and he hit the northern flank of the Marines. Both sides suffered many casualties, but the Marines held their ground, destroyed most of the tanks, and forced the Japanese to retreat. And again, we have something new in this battle that the Marines had not countered before, and that is civilians. Scott, what kind of challenges did they face because of these civilians?
Right, this is something completely new, and this happens on the 16th. On that morning, the Japanese launched a counterattack against the 4th Marine Division, and they put a number of civilians, including women and children, at the front of the attacking forces. They did so to create the impression that a surrender was taking place. So what the Marines had to do was hold their fire, but then once they discovered the ruse that this wasn't a surrender, then they annihilated the attackers. Now, it sounds like they're using decoys or they're using women and children as collateral damage, which happens in some ways. But as we're going to see later on, this isn't always the case. Sometimes these civilians are willfully getting involved in the fight for reasons that we'll see why. So this is something that we're going to see more and more as the U.S. Army gets closer and closer to the Japanese homeland. But yeah, just pay attention to this because this is going to affect strategy as the war goes on.
Right. And before we go any further, I should amend my characterization of the island of Saipan. I said it looked like a football. It's really more like a football with feet. Or it's shaped like almost like a dinosaur, like a brontosaurus or something. It has the back is the left side. That's the side that the Marines are invading. And on the right side, there's a couple of peninsulas that stick out. Those are the feet. And then in the northeast part, it's almost like there's a little head. It's an interesting shape for an island, but it's as we're going to see, it has a lot of great defensive ground for the defenders to dig in at. All right, so by the 18th, which is 3 days after the initial invasion, the Americans controlled most of the southern third of the island. But when they looked out at the American fleet, they saw that much of it was gone. Spruance had sent most of the warships to join up with Task Force 58 to meet the incoming Japanese fleet. See next episode. That is the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which is going on at the same time as the land battle of Saipan. By the 22nd, the American advance had stalled due to stiff Japanese resistance. And on the same day, a group of 74 U.S. Army Air Force P-47s landed on Aslito Airfield in the southern part of the island. So they've still got a lot of the island to take at this point, but it's always a good sign when you get control of an air base and you can actually use the air base. Now they're going to have these American planes actually on the island able to support further ground operations. All right. That's always helps, doesn't it, Scott?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Any more words of wisdom before I go on?
No, I mean, let's see, like, as you said, this is a different battle. This is much more like Guadalcanal due to the terrain. So,
yeah,
what do they face here?
Except this time they've got to take the whole island. Whereas in Guadalcanal, they really only operated on a relatively small portion of it. Of course, it's a much smaller island, so that helps. All right. On the 23rd of June, the 2nd and 4th Marine Divisions and the Army's 27th Infantry Division launched a coordinated attack. 27th Infantry, which was in the middle, moved more slowly than the Marines, and the American position soon had a U-shape. We talked about this in a previous episode, how the Marines and the Army had slightly different strategies or methods of operating. The Marines tended to emphasize speed and didn't put as much emphasis on trying to keep casualties down, whereas the Army was slower and more deliberate. In general, these are generalities, of course, and the Army was more they made keeping casualties down a higher priority than the Marines did. But the overall commander of the land force on the American side was our old friend, General Holland Smith, Howlin' Mad, they called him. And that was, he was howling mad at this point because he was not happy with the Army not going as fast as the Marines. And so he fired the Army's commander, the commander of the 27th Infantry Division. That's going to cause a strain between the Army and the Marines, but right now it seemed like the thing to do. And sure enough, within another week, the 27th caught up with the Marine divisions. The Marines captured Mount Topolchow in a bloody action. And Scott, I think you've got more on that.
Right. I mean, this was...
Flesh it out.
Yeah, very difficult. So Mount Topolchow, it's the island's highest point, 1,500 feet, not huge, but that's what you have on Saipan. So what the U.S. forces did is they gradually drove the Japanese defense from their very well dug in position in the heights. So as it goes on, Smith orders a contingent of troops to assault Japanese positions by moving across an exposed valley. And it was soon called Death Valley because this was an area that bordered a ridge where there were well-protected, heavily armed Japanese soldiers that were firing right down on the approaching Americans. The Marines dubbed it Purple Heart Ridge for the many American casualties there. After fighting their way through the jungle terrain, the Marines won control of the mountain by the end of June. So the Japanese are forced to retreat further north. And this is what most people would say is the turning point in the Battle of Saipan.
All right. So the Americans continued to push north as Japanese resistance gradually crumbled. Small groups of Japanese soldiers hid in caves, and often they charged out of them in bonsai attacks. Other times they were killed by Americans with grenades and flamethrowers. As the Americans advanced, their tanks, artillery, and machine guns devastated the remaining Japanese. In addition, this is a quote from Ian Toll, "The American land-based fighters and carrier planes rained down bombs, rockets, and strafing fire on the Japanese lines. To all of that was added the big guns of the warships operating offshore, which kept at it throughout the daylight hours and often continued into the night." That's the end of the quote. Altogether, 11,000 tons of naval shells landed on Saipan. 11,000 tons, that is a lot. That's like 22 million pounds. On July 6th, General Saito ordered a final bonsai attack. He issued the following statement. "Whether we attack or whether we stay where we are is only death. However, in death, there is life. We must utilize this opportunity to exalt true Japanese manhood. I will advance with those who remain to deliver still another blow to the American devils. I will leave my bones on Saipan as a bulwark for the Pacific."
Right. So, I mean, when I was reading about this attack, I mean, this is something different from what we've seen many times in the Pacific of bonsai attacks where an individual soldier or maybe a few of them will run out or maybe a few dozen. This is something different. This is called a Goyukusai attack, which means breaking the jewel. This is a reference for a destruction of an entire Japanese unit. And this isn't just done on the discretion of an individual captain or a general. This can only be done at the behest of the Imperial General Headquarters. And with this particular attack, it's estimated that more than 4,000 Japanese participated. So there's descriptions of this. It's just mind-boggling. So they began to assemble for the attack after dark on July 6th, and all wounded soldiers who weren't able to walk or bear arms were killed under the orders of the Japanese commanders. So first, those who couldn't participate were killed. Then the Japanese commanders, so what happens next is that everyone who was able to walk was armed with whatever weapons were available. And there aren't enough rifles for everyone. So you took whatever you could. Some of the men carried sticks or rocks or just about anything. So the attackers came on. Some were drunk on sake or beer, and they were led by about 200 officers who were waving swords and yelling at the top of their lungs. In front of the mass of men, there were about half a dozen carrying a large red flag, kind of like a vanguard. Well, they were a vanguard. Behind them came the troops, and most incredible, there were hundreds of limping and hobbling men with bandaged heads. So if you could walk in any capacity, even if you're severely injured, they were participating.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
One of the few officers who survived the attack were Major Edward McCarthy. He was in command of the 2nd Battalion of the 105th. And here's how he describes the scene. He said, "It reminded me of one of those old cattle stampede scenes of the movies. The camera's in a hole in the ground and you see the herd coming and they leap up and over you and are gone. Only the Japs just kept coming and coming. I didn't think they'd ever stop." So the Japanese troops swept down the narrow tracks of a railroad, which skirted the beach, and they hit the dug-in soldiers of the 105th. The Americans fought, and their weapons were positioned so the Japanese had to climb over them, and sometimes over their own dead, who were shot in order to get to them. But the troops kept coming and coming, and they overran the 2 battalions, the 105th, as well as the 10th Marine Artillery Battery. This had been placed in the rear of the 105th Regiment position. The Marines fought, and they fought very hard, but they were outnumbered and forced to abandon their field pieces to the enemy. And the following day, a number of Marines were found on the battlefield that were killed in hand-to-hand combat. And just another account, this was really incredible. Lieutenant Colonel William J. O'Brien, he was commander of the 1st Battalion. He took the lead in opposing the Japanese attack. He was left-handed, and he always carried a pistol in a shoulder holster under his right arm. And according to a division historian, O'Brien was responsible for the last stand by the men of his battalion when the Japanese first hit his perimeter. So he stood with a pistol in each hand, encouraged his men to hold off the enemy. He was wounded in his shoulder, but he refused to be evacuated. So O'Brien's running up and down the line. He's telling his troops to hold. And when the Japanese broke through, he grabbed a rifle from a wounded man in a foxhole and he fired on the enemy until he was out of ammo. He then manned a 50 caliber machine gun on a abandoned Jeep. He's sounding like Audie Murphy here. He's firing on the Japanese until once again, he runs out of ammo. When he was last seen alive, O'Brien was surrounded by saber-wielding Japanese officers and the bodies of the Japanese he killed. There were at least 30 dead Japanese soldiers found near his body. So one eyewitness to the battle, it was Sergeant John Breen of Company A of the 1st Battalion. He said that O'Brien was... It was just one of the boys that day. He died right on the front line with us. This is, quote, "His last words heard over the shrieks of the charging Japanese, the cries of his wounded soldiers, and the deafening gunfire were, 'Don't give them a damn inch.'" So this is the final attack, and very brutal. And what were the numbers, James, just for casualties from both sides?
Well, before we get into that, I should mention that author John Tolan in his book, The Rising Sun, has a great account of this battle. He has a great account of every battle, I should say. It's a great book. But he also gives you the Japanese perspective. And he tells the story from the viewpoint of several individual Japanese who were actually present there and who survived, including even people like nurses and others, not always soldiers. So if you it's like, I don't know, 900 pages. It's a huge book, but it covers the entire war. It's a good book. Not available on audio as far as I know, but highly recommended. John Tolan, Rising Sun, especially for this battle. All right, to sum it up, in this attack, this final cataclysmic decisive attack, about 400 Americans were killed, many by stabbing wounds because of the swords and the bayonets, but about 4,300 Japanese perished. So that's 10 times as many, more than 10 times. And on July 9th, the island was declared secure. So that's about 24 days after the initial attack. As in other battles, the Japanese forces preferred suicide to surrender. Admiral Nagumo shot himself on July 6th. 4 days later, General Saito, who, despite having said in that great speech earlier that I will advance with you, he did not advance with them. He stayed behind, but now he commits ritual suicide, seppuku. And that's essentially sticking a short sword or a long knife into your belly and then cutting it, you know, moving it left and right or right and left. I forget what the order is, but it doesn't matter. But basically, and sometimes they would even tear out their own intestines or and guts and just put them outside of them. So long, old practice going way back to the samurai days. I'm sure very painful and a horrible way to die, but that's what he did. He'd rather do that than and be captured. Japanese army leaders had told the civilian population of Saipan before the invasion that if they were captured, the Americans would torture them to death. As a result, when American soldiers asked them to come out of the caves they were hiding in, these civilians instead blew themselves up with grenades that the Japanese soldiers had given them. It's just really tragic. And even more tragic, or equally tragic, I should say, at Marpy Point, at the northernmost end of the island, with their backs to the sea and with American soldiers closing in and urging surrender, whole families committed suicide. Some blew themselves up with grenades while others threw their children over the edge of a cliff, then leapt themselves. Hundreds of Americans watched in horror. The psychological impact was profound and immeasurable. In all, 22,000 civilians died. We talked about how there were 30,000 on the island, so the overwhelming majority, more than two-thirds of them died, mostly from suicide. Bodies floated off the shore for many more days, some even getting caught in the ship's screws. The ships had to kind of go away from the land a little bit so that they didn't get damaged by running across these bodies. Awful, awful stuff, Scott.
Right. And this is something that I hope this makes sense for a military strategic standpoint as we get closer to Japan. We're going to talk about things like Curtis LeMay's order for the firebombing of Tokyo that killed more than the atomic bombs. Decades after World War II, people will talk about war crimes committed in Japan by the U.S. military and all the different strategies. So listeners, we're going to explain all these things. We're not going to tell you how to think on these matters, but just to give context of why decisions were made at the time. And this is informing military strategy, where you have civilian populations that are propagandized and radicalized. This informs U.S. military planning for the eventual occupation and conquest of Japan. What will you do if, based on what we experience in Saipan, where civilians are committing suicide, they're attacking us because they believe we're going to do these things to them. What do you do when you're occupying a nation that every single man, woman, and child could be a potential enemy combatant? What do you do? This isn't Europe. When you get deep into the heart of Germany, sure, you'll find a 14-year-old who's a brainwashed member of the Hitler Youth. Sure, you'll encounter that, and that absolutely is something that happens in the final days in 1945, right before the downfall of Germany. But it's absolutely incomparable to what's found in the Pacific. So we'll, as we talk about the strategies that are being drawn up for the eventual occupation of Japan in the fall of 1945 and the spring of 1946, it's episodes like these on Saipan that are informing military command. And today, when people talk about the necessity of the dropping of the atomic bomb, the necessity of the firebombing of Tokyo, and all these different things that seem horrific, the counterpoint usually is, well, the alternative would have been infinitely worse. You would have to go mile by mile, street by street, encountering this. And we didn't want another Saipan writ large expanded to an entire nation of Japan. It would have been too horrifying to even imagine what that would have been like. So we'll dig into it more, but I think the starting point is really Saipan, of what the U.S. will be encountering as they're coming across civilian populations like this.
Yes. So let's wrap it up. Saipan, you could kind of say it's the beginning of the end. This is another, if we did a series on turning points, which again, as everybody knows, we've said it many times, Scott and I are a little bit cynical about the idea of, or skeptical, I should say, about the idea of turning points. But there, it is a legitimate concept, a turning point. And I would say this is definitely one of them, because now they're only a few hundred miles from Japan, the Americans are, and that now they can actually reach them with long-range bombers. And we'll spend a lot of time talking about that later. Don't you worry. We will spend a whole episode on bomber operations. But for now, let's just say that Saipan was the most costly battle of the Pacific War to that point. Key word there is to that point. It's going to get worse before it gets better. The Americans suffered nearly 14,000 casualties, including about 3,500 killed, 3,500, and 10,500 wounded. Japanese military losses were 29,000, nearly all of which were deaths. 24,000 were killed in action, and 5,000 committed suicide. That's just 5,000 suicides. The Americans captured only 736 prisoners of war, and those were mostly Korean laborers. Very few Japanese soldiers surrendered. Scott, what did you want to add to that?
Well, I think I'll have to dig up some more research here, but I want to follow up on this point. I'll bring this numbers in this argument later on, but I think I saw an analysis that what did it cost Japan in the war by not surrendering? Now, of course, there's the entire military ethos that happens here that undergirds the war for Japan to the honor. We talked about the military code that soldiers learned that duty is heavier than a mountain, death is lighter than, you know, goose down pillows, whatever translation you want. So this is the ethos. But if we're just talking in terms of pure military strategy, it's a foolish move to commit suicide rather than surrender. Okay, surrender, yes, technically you're out of the war, but think about how much it ties down your enemy if they're adhering to the Geneva Convention and they're constructing POW camps. They have to handle all the logistics. What do you do with these enemy combatants? You have to feed them. You have to do all these different things. You have to provide provisions for them. You have guards for the POW camp. So it leaves men tied down. Logistically, what would you do with these Japanese soldiers? If you took them off the island of Saipan, you would have to tie down transports that could otherwise be used for U.S. troops, take them to a friendly island. Once the war is over, you have to return them. The provisions that would go to your own troops have to be taken to them. So if you, as the war goes on, you have more and more and more soldiers you have to handle, this could conceivably slow down your own military by a certain amount of time. So from only speaking in terms of real politic, completely divorced from ideology, that's something that could have very well slowed down the U.S. Now, I don't know by how much, and I'll have to look into this more later, which I can provide, but that's ironically, I mean, as horrifying it is to the troops on the grounds, and don't want to by any means diminish the experiences that Marines and troops and others encountered when they see a bonsai attack firsthand, or this entire, you know, contingent of hundreds and thousands of men charging them. It's making it easier for the U.S. in the long run because of these logistical issues they don't want to have to deal with. So from a purely strategic standpoint, not very good in the long run.
Right. Now, this battle also has political ramifications because the Japanese loss of Saipan resulted in Prime Minister Tojo being forced from office. Tojo's been in office for 3 years, which is an eternity for a Japanese prime minister back at this time. And he'd been running the war effort, but now he's gone. He's replaced by another general, Kuniaki Koiso, who will not wield near as much power as Tojo did. Officially, the new government was committed to continuing the war, but privately, it began to look for a way to end it. And I'll at least the main part of the episode, I'll let historian Ian Toll, one of my favorites, have the final word. He said, quote, "Though Americans were slow to appreciate it, they had just won the decisive victory of the Pacific War," end quote. Scott, you had another quote from another great World War II scholar, right?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite quotes about World War II. This comes from an interview I did with a book author called 40 Thieves of Saipan about military snipers and reconnaissance scouts, which listeners, if you want to listen to that interview, I think it adds a lot of context here, but I didn't mention too much because I didn't want to insert too much into or get out of the way of the main narrative. But this comes from Eleanor Roosevelt. She actually visited the Pacific Theater. She met with Marines. And what's funny is when she met with them and stepped off the plane, they booed her. Why would you boo the first lady? Well, the Marines were expecting, a USO trip, perhaps a Hollywood starlet, an attractive young woman they could feast their eyes upon after being around smelly guys for months in the jungle in hard combat. But after visiting them, she made this observation, and Eleanor Roosevelt said, "The Marines I've met around the world have the cleanest bodies, the filthiest minds, the highest morale, and the lowest morals of any group of animals I have ever seen. Thank God for the United States Marines." There you go.
Oh, that's a great quote. I love it.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
One more thing I wanted to add is I haven't talked about a movie in a while, but there is a movie that deals with the Battle of Saipan. It's not a, not really about Saipan per se, like say the Battle of Midway movie or the Thin Red Line is about Guadalcanal or Tora Tora Tora, but it's set in Saipan and it deals with a group of underknown and underappreciated heroes in World War II, and that is the Navajo Code Talkers. And I'm going to actually, in a future episode, I'm going to devote maybe half of an episode or so to discussing them. But the Navajo Code Talkers were recruited off of the Navajo Reservation, and they were used to transmit American orders and other instructions over the radio by just simply using their own native language, the Navajo language, which is a very rare language, very complex language spoken by very few people, instead of using some kind of code. And it totally confused the Japanese, and it they never cracked the code. They couldn't understand what is this. I don't understand it at all. And so they were used not just at Saipan, but in almost all the major battles of the Pacific Theater. But I just wanted to give this movie a shout out. It's called Wind Talkers. Some of our listeners may have seen it. It came out in 2002. It's not super realistic. It's kind of cliched in some places, and it didn't get really high critical ratings, but I like it. At least they tried to give some recognition to these heroes who in the war, and certainly at this battle as well. So Wind Talkers, check it out. Don't expect it to be as good as, say, what's a great World War II movie like Patton or Tora Tora Tora, or it's not going to be Thin Red Line. It's not going to be that good. It's not like 1917 for World War I, but it's worthy of watching, especially if you're a history buff. Okay, that is it. We've wrapped up the Battle of Saipan. Huge turning point in the campaign. I use the word turning point, Scott. Oh, well. I just can't get away from it. But a super important battle, game changer. And however, during the episode, I did mention at one point that the U.S. Navy kind of pulled away from the shore. What were they doing all this time? Well, they had other things to do. They got a little bit busy because the Japanese fleet showed up and decided they didn't want to lose Saipan. They wanted to at least challenge it. And that led to what is called the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which is our sixth key battle. And that will be the topic of our next episode. I look forward to seeing you then.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, which is called American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. Fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for key battles of American history. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C. and Bob McCullough, Captains Jenny Kateri, Jeff Henley, Grant Holstrom, Jose Martinez, and Melissa Mueller, and Lieutenants Matthew Christensen, Scott Hendricks, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.